Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to episode 103 of the Bulaq podcast. I'm Marshalink Squaley, joining you from Rabat, Morocco. And as usual, Ursula Lindsay is with me in Amman, Jordan. We're also joined today by Hazem Jamjoum in London as a special guest to talk about the nonfiction works of Ghassan Kanafani. Hazem Jamjoum is a scholar, writer, and translator. He was also senior producer and host of the radio shows Kenya McCann on Toronto's CKLN and of Unfortunately, It Was Paradise on WNYU. Ghassan Kanafani's The Revolution of 1936 to 1939 in Palestine, which first appeared in 1972 and was published in his translation last fall by 1804 Press, is his first book-length translation. His translation of Maya Abul-Hayat's novel, No One Knows Their Blood Type, is due to be published by the Cleveland State University Poetry Center this fall. And while Kanafani is primarily known for his fiction, and selected works of Kanafani's fiction started to appear in English translation in the 70s, he also, during his lifetime, his very short lifetime, published significant scholarly and academic works. Among them were several literary studies, and there was also a recent translation by Mahmoud Najib of one of them, his 1967 On Zionist Literature, which came out from Ebb Books in 2022. So first, of course, Hazem, thank you so much for joining us. We're really delighted that you're here.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
So I think we wanted to start, you know, just with this kind of basic, Kanafani, I believe, will be familiar to, you know, 99.9% of our listeners. But just to start out by kind of sketching out this, you know, brief portrait of him as both, you know, him in his entirety. So, you know, born in 1936, assassinated by Israeli intelligence services in 1972, he wrote an immense amount in the middle. And if you could just talk about kind of fleshing out our understanding of him as a writer, as a political commentator.
Yeah, so Kanafani, I think, starts his creative and political life in many ways as a short story writer. And as you said, he was prolific as a short story writer. He was a teacher in UNRWA schools in Damascus and then gets a job in Kuwait and then ultimately comes back to Syria and Lebanon and is based in Beirut. While a teenager, like maybe age 18, 19, he meets George Habash, who recognizes Ghassan Kanafani's literary talent and starts to bring him into work as an editor on periodicals that are mouthpieces for the Arab nationalist movement or the movement of Arab nationalists, Harakat al-Qawmiyyin al-Arab, of which Habash was one of the co-founders. And I think one of the things that's really maybe forgotten about Kanafani and maybe underappreciated in general is that one of his greatest contributions was actually as an editor. And so when he writes, for example, about resistance literature, effectively introducing Arabs and Palestinians to the resistance writing of those poets in the part of Palestine occupied in 1948, like Mahmoud Darwish and Samih al-Qasim. He's published some of these in these periodicals, like Al-Ra'i and then ending in Al-Hadaf, the kind of main organ of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. He's also the first to publish Najil Ali, the caricature art, the great caricature, political caricature artist, before the birth of Handala. I think the story goes that I think Najil Ali was working as a janitor in the publication where Kanafani was an editor, and had done some sketches, some doodles, and Kanafani said something like, "You're really talented. You should do some of these for the newspaper, for the magazine." And that was the beginning of Najil Ali as a published caricature artist, and the rest is a very important history. Najil Ali also assassinated, most likely by Israeli intelligence, or almost definitely by Israeli intelligence. So I think, yes, this kind of role as an editor, he continues to write fiction, and I think that's probably what he's most famous for, particularly his first long form novel, novella, Rijal fi Shams, Men in the Sun, which I think also gained a bit more attention in the past 20 years as people were mobilizing against deportation and the kind of global border regime, and these kind of like migrant detention centers and so on and so forth. And it really spoke to that movement, and has that kind of lasting power. It's also been adapted into a film, The Dupes, Al-Makhdu'un. So he goes on to write two more novellas. Another one that's also been translated, Ha'id ila Haifa, Return to Haifa, which is, I mean, I think some people see it as a bit of a shift in his thinking, but I don't think so. But I think there's this sort of really powerful thing in that story where you have this Palestinian couple who, after the 1967 occupation, are able to go and see their home in Haifa and kind of encounter the family living there, only to discover that that family's son, who's joining the Israeli military, is actually their son who was left behind in the Nakba. And that kind of, I think, this really powerful statement that you are your choices, not what you're born into, that being, you know, it's not about being born into biologically a community. It's about the choice you make and the solidarities you choose, and who you see as the people you're willing to kind of like fight for and die for. And I think the sort of the Saad is, I think, the last novella he writites. And Saad is for many, probably his greatest piece of fiction, even though it's maybe the one that gets the least attention. In a way, it's sort of a character study of this woman in the refugee camp who is cleaning other people's homes and has to contend with the idea of her son joining the resistance, which will kind of, you know, almost certainly lead to him being harmed, or killed, martyred. And kind of balancing that with the kind of collective need for freedom and return that requires that kind of sacrifice. And again, this is the stuff that, you know, this his literary output is what he's most famous for. His nonfiction work is where he was actually most prolific, I think. The number of articles he wrote under his own name, the number of articles he wrote under a pen name, different pen names, one in particular, Faris, those have been at least collected. I don't think we'll ever know everything he wrote because he used different pen names. But then there's also these unpublished and published studies. So the main published ones, like you mentioned, are the one I recently translated about the 1936 revolution, which was the last one of its kind that he wrote, that he published in Shu'un Falastiniya. But then he'd also written on Zionist literature, and he'd written on resistance literature, these kind of landmark essays. Each in its own way.
And could you also talk a bit about his political commitments? Because like you said, I think he is perhaps the person who coined the term resistance literature, or at least it's very strongly associated with him. But all of his writing went alongside with also an enormous amount of political activism.
Well, he was a leading member, like a political bureau member, of the movement of Arab nationalists, or the Arab nationalist movement. You'll see it in English written and translated in different ways. and you know, this was a movement that was about the liberation of the Arab world from dictatorships and foreign colonial power, and saw that the means to this kind of freedom was militant armed struggle. And after the 1967 war, the movement of Arab nationalists kind of, I don't think it's so much splintered as it split into areas of emphasis. And so it turned into things like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Oman and the Arab Gulf, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And he was in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Again, Politburo member, you know, many people will say that he played a leading part in writing its manifesto, but he definitely was in charge of, you know, communications to the masses. And he made the slogan of Al Hadaf, the magazine he that was the main organ of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, "Kull al haqiqa lil jamaahir," so to the masses only the truth and all of the truth, effectively. So a response to a notion of politics as something that needs to be done behind closed doors, and requires this kind of like strategies and tactics where you effectively end up lying to the people that you are supposed to be accountable to and representing and fighting for, and coordinating the fight of, that no, the role of a revolutionary party is also to shine light and show the truth as it is. And I think it wasn't just a slogan. It's very much, if you go through the pages of Al-Hadaf, it's very much geared towards that kind of truth telling. And, you know, his role as an editor in these different publications that he was a part of was also not about just towing a particular party line. There's something really fascinating about Kanafani because he, you know, generally these kinds of vanguardist parties that are about being 10 steps ahead of the masses and whatnot, they place a high premium on towing the party line and on a certain kind of conformity, at least in public. So if we are going to disagree, we disagree in-house, but then we present that united front to the public. Kanafani definitely, you know, he helped formulate and was a big part of formulating the party line, but then the party needed to operate under circumstances not of its choosing. So it had to contend with alliances with tyrannical regimes. It had to contend with Soviet power. It had to contend with who was providing support and strategic depth and a place for people to train and study and meet safely. And so it had to compromise on what Kanafani definitely saw as somehow like a truer revolutionary line. And where you see that is in, for example, the writings that he published under pseudonyms, where he departs from the party line. If you go through Al-Hadaf, you'll also find several instances where Kanafani will have written effectively an editorial in the previous issue that may cause some problems with a potential ally or partner or whatnot. And then in the next issue, a disclaimer saying that like Ghassan's article in the last issue was Ghassan's own personal opinion and does not reflect the party line. and then, you know, Dar al-Rimal has published recently, I mean, not that recently anymore, I guess, but about a decade ago, maybe now. No, like 5-6 years ago, they published a collected... So there is this sort of older collected works of Kanafani, which divides up his novellas from his short stories, from his plays. But they published the fifth volume when Dar al-Rimal reissued these. And it was these political writings. And it included a couple of unpublished ones. And the ones that are kind of very present in my mind are this travelogue, which hopefully will also be translated someday in the not too distant future. But this essay on Marxism, a kind of primer on Marxism, and it's not an orthodox Marxism. It's not Stalinist Marxism. It's actually, if anything, much closer to a kind of anarcho-communism or a libertarian Marxism in some way. And I think that might be an entryway to understanding, I don't know if we're going to call him a bit of like a heterodox-ness in his thinking and his politics.
Yeah, he always he seems to me that he always had this part of his personality that was an educator, and that, you know, to me the 1936 to 39 book feels like part of that. I read in some PFLP document that he believed that people who struggle for liberation must know their history, and that this was part of a modern history that he had intended to write, but that only this part came out because of his assassination, that he never completed the rest of the project. And so I wanted to know why you know, why he started here. What is this book's particular significance? What, you know, if you could talk about in, and, you know, of course, what brought you to this book as well?
First of all, I think the timing of the book is a really interesting thing. So I'm trained as a historian. So there's a bit of maybe, I don't know, there's something in this moment that he decides to write it. So he's already had, I mean, not long, but prolific, 2 decades of writing under his belt in a way. When he writes this book, he publishes this essay, a year and a few months before his assassination. So it's one of the last things he publishes. And he writes it in the wake not only of the 1967 war defeat and occupation, but after what is perhaps a more significant defeat, which is the defeat in Jordan. So in 1970, the Jordanian monarchy kind of decided it was going to make its move, you know, with its U.S. imperial backers and by most accounts with a lot of coordination with the Israelis and even a Pakistani general who came to be part of the coordination from the very top to consolidate the monarchy against what it perceived to be correctly as a revolutionary threat in Jordanian society. The armed wing of which was very much organized under the militant factions of the PLO. So, you know, some people will talk about this Jordanian civil war or what's often remembered as Black September or Eylul al-Aswad as a sort of Jordanian versus Palestinian moment, which is very, very far from the truth. You know, there are several Palestinians who were close advisors of the Jordanian monarch, and there were thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Jordanians, people quote-unquote Jordanians. Let's also sort of remind ourselves that that border didn't exist for very long before this happened, who either were in the military and defected to the PLO militant factions or were already in the PLO militant factions. There were also, you know, like Naif Hawatme is considered an East Jordanian, and he's always been the head of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the major four Palestinian political militant factions at the time. This 1970 September civil war in Jordan, effective, I mean, an onslaught onto the PLO's presence in Jordan, political and military, results in widespread massacres in the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan by the Jordanian regime. And then what remains of the fighters kind of withdraw to these woodlands in the north near Jarash. And then they are, you know, and then there's a full-on aerial kind of onslaught to wipe them out, and which leads to the relocation of the PLO base to Lebanon. But this moment, this 1970-1971 moment, is the moment where it looks like almost all is lost, right? So Jordan is the main landmass where Palestinians are able to train. It's the largest border with occupied Palestine. You know, it's where the revolution is. Everything else is a satellite or an extension of, but really the whole idea of the liberation, especially post-1967, so as I'm sure many of your listeners know, in 1968, there's a very important battle called the Battle of Karameh, where PLO fighters backed by Jordanian artillery, which by many accounts comes about because the commander of that artillery unit goes against the orders to withdraw his troops. And decides to join the battle. And effectively, they're victorious in pushing back an Israeli attack on a Palestinian military base and refugee camp in Karameh in the Jordan Valley. The result of Karameh and the narrative around Karameh that emerges is what effectively kind of begins what we think of as the Palestinian Revolution. This is people sort of flocking in droves to PLO offices in the refugee camps across Jordan saying, I want to sign up. Where do I sign up? Give me a gun. I want to fight. Mm. And this begins this kind of really interesting golden era where, you know, even like women are fighting with their families or their families are like, yes, daughter, go. But organizing to have like their own training, where you have people from revolutionary and national liberation movements all over the world flocking to join this as well. And a kind of high point of Palestinian internationalism, not the only one. And then for this to be defeated in this brutal way, right? There's still mass graves in Jordan that nobody talks about from this. There's still remnants of artillery and bullet and munitions up in the woods near Jarash, where the onslaught on the fighters was. And it's not something that's talked about, right? So Palestinians in Jordan don't really want to bring it up because it brings up old wounds and there's no need to antagonize the regime anymore. And definitely the regime has no interest in these stories being brought up either. But Kanafani is here in this moment of what feels like the lowest low point, right? That people thought it was bad in the wake of the 1967 war. People had committed suicide. It was this sort of like mass depression that overcame the entire Arab world. Only to have this glimmer of hope in this post-Karameh period be dashed quite mercilessly and bloodily in 1970-71. And so Kanafani, who's written, you know, short stories and novellas and literary kind of lit crit and, you know, literary analysis, now turns his hand and his pen to the study of history, that this is what we need now. Is an understanding of history. I find that really fascinating. And the rest of his writing is not particularly historical. So in some ways...
And he also turns it to a particular moment in history that he is resonating clearly.
Yeah. So he effectively, you know, it's actually really telling to read the very first sentence in the book. It's a difficult sentence to translate in and even the Arabic is a little bit, and this is something Kanafani does, is he'll kind of sometimes use this technique where he'll say something that he knows is vague, but he can't make it be more precise just yet. You need to read till the end so that you can come back and understand that opening point, you know? So he opens this essay by saying, in the years 1936 to 1939, the Palestinian revolutionary movement was dealt a devastating blow by the three formations that have since evolved to become the major forces working against the people of Palestine. Reactionary Palestinian leaders, Arab regimes surrounding Palestine, and the alliance between Zionism and imperialism. So this, I think, is also the punchline of the text. It's just, what does he mean by formations, et cetera, et cetera. But effectively, he's saying there's this triumvirate. And I think what he's doing is, because he's not, this isn't history for its history's sake. This isn't history just like because an archive has been revealed and we can now go tell that story. He's born on the eve of this uprising. He's born, I think, during the general strike. That leads to this uprising. So this uprising has been with him his whole life. He's been hearing stories about it. He you know, from people who participated and led in it. So if you think about the PFLP founders, you know, this also includes people like Abu Maher al-Yamani, who was one of the leaders of the strike in 1936. So I think what he's doing is he's saying that like these three, this triumvirate of the Palestinian leadership, the kind of imperially backed Zionism, and the Arab regimes surrounding Palestine, these reactionary regimes, that this is actually the same set of forces, or these are the set of forces that the Palestinian revolution is facing. And I think he picks 1936 as the moment where that becomes the case. That sort of up until 1936, it's still unclear what the constellation of forces that this revolution needs to overcome is. Is it just the British mandate? You know, the 1920s is a moment of flux. And then you hit the Great Depression and the election of the Nazis in 1932. And, you know, by the end of the 1920s, the Zionist movement had been a complete failure, right? By the end of the 1920s, I think there's no more than 60 to 80,000 Jews who'd migrated as part of the Zionist movement to Palestine. A far cry. You have a million non-Jewish Palestinians. This is not going to create a Jewish state. So, you know, when we hit 1930, we don't know if Zionism's going to go anywhere. Like, if they're going to be able to convince Jews to leave other places. And, you know, they're not even interested in all Jews at this point. They're only interested in white Jews in the 1920s. And so they're only going after people in Europe and North America for the most part, in terms of the activities of the Jewish agency. But then between the Great Depression and then the most importantly, the election of the Nazi party and the Nazis taking over power, and it becoming patently unsafe to be Jewish in Europe anymore, that's what changes the game, right? That's what enables Zionism to have enough of a population to say this is a viable project now. Zionism is a viable project. We could create a state here. So you have this massive rise in immigration that happens in the early 1930s of people seeking safety from the rise of fascism. And this kind of comes to a head in 1936. And this is that moment. And not just in 1936, but that entire revolution. So from 1935 and Ezzedine Qassam's assassination through to the general strike for 6 months, through to the sustained 4 years of military insurrection and uprising against the British occupation and its facilitation of Zionist colonization. This is where that crystallizes. And that's the story he's telling. In this book.
So that's
why he picked this moment.
It seems to me you write about a moment when things could have been different in order to, you know, perhaps influence things changing in the future. Do we have some sense of the reception of who he imagined his audience being, the effect that he was hoping? I mean, there's a lot of class analysis in it, so we can assume that part of what he imagined it doing was, you know, people sort of understanding the situation on the ground differently. But what impact do you think that he wanted this to have?
Well, in terms of imagined audience, we can actually have a very clear idea because we know where he published it. So he published it in this phenomenal revolutionary journal called Shu'un Falastaniya. Shu'un Falastaniya was a project initiated by Anis Sayegh at the PLO Research Center, which was a really, you know, that's also the what gave us the Palestine Encyclopedia, that multi-volume encyclopedia of Palestine, and several other really important projects. So the Shu'un Falastaniya was, and I highly recommend that people try to find copies and look through this. First of all, it has beautiful cover art. but more importantly, Anis Sayegh basically made it revolutionary social media in a way. Like there was no strong editorial line per se. Palestinian academics in the United States, military commanders who'd participated in revolutionary struggles elsewhere, Palestinian military commanders, people in the field, journalists, so on, all kind of having effectively a public conversation on how do we get free, with a very strong emphasis on including a lot of things like book reviews, theater reviews, theoretical writings on aesthetics, philosophical interventions. And so, you know, there was no kind of singular focus. The focus was about, you know, how do we elevate ourselves as an Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movement? And I don't know if any other movement has produced anything quite like it. And Kanafani was very close to this magazine. It was only in its second year that he was assassinated. And you can see his imprint on almost all of the issues up until his assassination and into the next one. There was an assassination attempt also on Anissa Sayegh, the editor of it, around the same time as Kanafani. And so in the following issue, Anissa Sayegh writes an intro that kind of combines a, here's what happened to me, and sort of obituary for Kanafani. And then the whole issue is effectively obituary for Kanafani. I'm pretty sure the cover has some kind of stencil of Kanafani's face. So the readership for Shu'un Falastiniya was effectively like, you know, the way that the readership of Al-Muqtataf would have been like Arabic speakers who fancied themselves moderns. Shu'un Falastiniya was readership was Arab speakers and readers who fancied themselves part of the revolution, or people who wanted to monitor what those pesky revolutionaries were saying, and definitely many an intelligence agency. So I think that's the readership. So he this was probably the best forum for this, and that's who he wanted everyone who cared to read this.
Hasim, I just want to go back to the subject of the book itself. For people who may not know that much about the 1936-39 revolution, just to explain what happened and why it failed and what Kanafani's analysis of it failing is, but also just the key events and the key demands and the key players in these 4 years?
Well, there's sort of two answers to this. One is the, like, what happened in Kanafani's telling. It remains one of the best accounts, even though it was written so long ago, 50 years plus ago. So that's half a century. That's more time has elapsed since he wrote it than had elapsed between the revolution and him writing it. So it starts as that general strike. It moves into the countryside as armed guerrilla warfare, primarily staffed by Palestinian peasants.
And people are revolting against the sort of the British decision to establish a Jewish state in Palestine, against the increased migration. Jewish migration to Palestine, and against the loss of land? I mean, are those the main sort of drivers of the strike and
those
the revolt?
Those are the main drivers, and in that order. So the British occupation, the fact that it is operating with a Balfour Declaration mandate to create a Jewish state, and is acting systematically and discriminatorily in every field of life to give the Zionists an upper hand on the indigenous population. And is crushing dissent, right? Is operating a police state against Palestinians while also really encouraging Zionist capital. In many ways it's sort of your bread and butter anti-colonial, anti-imperial military fight or guerrilla insurrection. But what makes it very particular, and this is one of the main points Kanafani is making, is that, if we assume there is a sort of normal progression to an anti-colonial fight, so the normal progression would be, in Kanafani's telling, quite accurate, and it applies to basically the rest of the Arab world, which is a point he is consistently making. That's his main point of comparison, is other Arab states or other Arab societies. That the kind of an elite from that indigenous society, so usually a landholding, high status elite, effectively sees that their best option to maintain their privilege is to find a way to negotiate with the imperial power and sort of concede whatever it is that the imperial power really requires. you know, economic control, ultimate control over military and foreign policy, these kinds of things, in return for installing that elite as a ruling class, as a kind of semi-sovereign ruling class in their society. And the argument that Kanafani says, that makes about the exceptional nature of Palestine is that the Zionist movement provides the imperial power with a much more efficient, much more pliant, much more within the racial imaginary, sort of allied and close body, institutionalized body, to hand over that sovereignty to. And so he paints this also very historically accurate, but, you know, pathetic. It's a lampooning of these Palestinian elites. Let's remember also when he lists those three formations that he says are the ones dealing devastating blows to the revolution. The first that he lists are the reactionary Palestinian leaders. That's who goes in for the heaviest criticism in this book. And I think that is also extremely relevant in terms of the timing when he writes this in 1971. And we can come back to that. Or I'd like if we come back to that. And so he goes into detail, especially in telling the story of Izzeddin al-Qassam's, the assassination of Izzeddin al-Qassam, and how the popular movement kind of erupts after that, and how these kind of buffoonish Arab leaders are off like begging London and the High Commissioner for just any scraps of the table, anything that would let them save face, anything that would enable them to say, look, we've gotten this concession, we have sovereignty over this, or we have autonomous decision making over that. And the British are just like, why on earth would we do that? No, beg some more if you like, but we're not, you know, you're not going to get anything off of us because we have these Zionists to give stuff to. Like they can deliver. Why would I give you anything? And so he goes to quite some length. It's almost like play by play, showing this pattern of behavior over and over again, where this elite is rushing to present itself as the most pliant, you know, puppy dog, lap dogs that the British Empire could hope for, and failing at it, you know. And so ultimately, the British bring a lot more influence to bear on neighboring reactionary Arab regimes, Jordan in particular, but also in Lebanon, to you know, where the French are backing them up, to find anybody who's involved in supporting, supplying, participating in the revolution in Palestine, and arresting and condemning to death, the wide-scale use of the carceral system and imprisonment by the British in Palestine, the use of brutal force, and then the mobilization and training of Zionist forces to be part of the crackdown effort. Yeah, and so ultimately this revolution is one of the key points of the doctrine of pacification. Like the British Empire learns from the 1930s uprising, like develops new doctrines. And one of these is this also, he puts a bit of time into talking about Ord Wingate, who the British send over to as one of the people who's going to train Zionist fighters in the art of retribution. And so the very relevant for today, the very beginning of a systematic use of collective punishment in retaliation for anything, right? So I find a rifle with you, I destroy your family's house, you participate in an operation, I come and I harm the entire village, you know, by humiliating people publicly, harming them, killing them, etc., arresting, torturing, and so on, as a kind of deterrence terrorism that the British and Zionist kind of alliance is able to enact and will enact and to kind of make you expect that, you know, if you do anything that's part of the resistance, we will enact this upon you.
I wanted to ask a question about what you were saying about the elites and the Palestinian reactionary elites. Isn't part of his argument also that partly because they are of no use to the British, they do end up, sort of the notables end up being the nominal leaders and figureheads of this uprising, even as they're not particularly committed to it, and that is completely works against the uprising, that it is to its huge disadvantage that the people who managed to sort of appropriate its leadership almost unwillingly, like forced into it by public opinion and circumstances, are, you know, not committed leaders themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's also not just that they're forced into it by the popular pressure. It's that they, you know, and again, that normal progression would be that the imperial power would then be like, oh no, there's this movement. All right, this elite is the one that's most pliant and is already best suited and situated to kind of make this less of a headache, and we can run this at the lowest cost possible. Because the imperial power is not giving them that option, their only option for staying relevant is, and he uses this metaphor a few times, is to basically kind of like swim after the crest of the wave. Mm. So the popular movement is way ahead of it. The imperial power, which has this, you know, like strong boat that could make it go as far as it wants, is just like, no, I'm not letting you into the boat. And so they're having to kind of like splash around and try to get to catch up with the wave. Of this popular rejection of imperialism and colonialism. Yeah, completely. And, you know, so this is the other thing I was going to... So this, I said there's two ways to tell this. The other way to tell this is actually to focus on his methodology. So you said that there's a lot of class analysis in this. It's not just that there's a lot of class analysis in it. One of its main contributions is to say, here's a methodology for studying the past in a materialist way that can help us understand our present. And so the way that the book is organized is actually kind of by class. And again, he's actually operating with another historical narrative arc. So history writing, as we all know, is based on literary writing. So the discipline effectively emerges from people like Ian van Ranke, who models his writing on Scott, you know, on things like Ivanhoe. So the normal kind of Marxist narrative arc is one where the workers kind of organize and take over the means of production. And so he starts with the workers. He's basically telling us, all right, let's see how this compares to what should be the normal arc of a revolutionary movement. And sort of in keeping with the author of Ha'ed ila Haifa, of Return to Haifa, he's completely agnostic about which workers it is. It's not about whether it's Palestinian workers or Jewish workers or both. He's just like, okay, where are the workers and what are they doing? And good communist that he is, he immediately zeroes in on the Communist Party because that's where the working class is going to be organizing. And only to perform the discovery, he's grown up with these stories, so it's not like he discovered this as a result of his research. But now that he has this kind of analysis, he's able to rethink it and present it to us. He says, well, this Communist Party is actually Jewish-dominated, not necessarily Zionist Jewish-dominated, but Jewish-dominated. And it's effectively only really interested in Jewish workers and kind of paying lip service to the notion of also bringing in Arab workers. But then when they have these conferences, both the Palestine Communist Party, but then also the kind of Comintern Congress, which gives them some directives, in both cases, these congresses are saying that the only way to become relevant, this is especially after the uprising in 1929, so in the very early 30s, they basically make this decision to Arabize the party. We have to go after the Arab working class, and they need to come in and be part of the leadership of this thing, if this is ever going to be a proper communist party. And so Kanafani effectively says, and they failed, right? So he's like, it was too little too late, in terms of their ability to do this. But then he turns his attention to these Palestinian workers associations, that had formed, effectively workers union, almost like a federated one. Well, not so much federated, but a united kind of thing. Didn't matter which sector you were in. You could join this workers' association. And they were in the big cities. And they were identified as a threat by the Palestinian elite, by the Mufti, effectively. So by Amin al-Husseini. He saw them as a major threat. And he had their major organizer assassinated. Right? And so he's So here he effectively says, like, the workers are effectively sidelined. They do something incredible in the organization of that general strike, which is part of why their leadership is targeted. And we should remember that the Mufti Amin al-Husseini was a stooge of the British Empire before he became a stooge of the Nazi Empire. And so then he moves on to the peasants, and he shows, just so as he does with the workers, he shows these incredible disparities, just the incredible amount of suffering imposed by not just the kind of the military boot of British imperialism, but actually by political economic policy, by sort of discrimination in terms of wage, discrimination in terms of the conditions to which a peasant brings their goods to market, and so on, and these incredible disparities. And then he moves on to probably one of the most fascinating chapters in the entire book, in the entire essay, which is the one on intellectuals. And here he's talking about the kind of more privileged urban class and propertied class, their sons and daughters, especially the sons who've gone on and studied in places like Beirut and Cairo and come back as Nahdawis, and come back as, you know, these modernizers and whatnot, only to find that unlike their Egyptian and Syrian and so on, like compatriots, who they've studied with and whatnot, they don't get to come back and expect to inherit daddy's factory because daddy doesn't have a factory. Or that if they are going to inherit Baba's land, they're not going to be enabled to do that kind of like modernizing transformation that they're fully charged with as a result of their time in their studies. Combined with, and so they turn to things like, you know, poetry primarily. So Kanafani is very much focused on the poetry, and there's that chapter is full of these excerpts from the poetry. And effectively, he says something like, there's practically no poet at the time who did not lend their pen to the revolution in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And obviously, he's thinking about, you know, people like Ibrahim Tuqan and so on and so forth. But if we were going to talk about why I translated this book, you know, I read this book maybe 17, 18 years ago. It's something in the chapter on the intellectuals. It's actually a footnote in the chapter on the intellectuals where he gives examples of sayings that were common in the early 30s in Palestine, all of which effectively encourage a certain kind of quietism, a certain kind of like, if you stick your neck out. You remember that?
Yeah, there's sort of a beautiful literary criticism of proverbs in sort of embedded in this text too.
Yeah, it's like a banger of a footnote.
Right. And that, that's the one thing that stuck with me. I mean, that and this notion that in order to explain the Nakba of 1948, we need to look at the devastation caused by the 1936 revolution. That was my simplistic kind of teenager reading of this, right? On rereading, you see these sort of like the much further depths.
I think one thing that's so remarkable about his writing, and it actually applies to both his fiction and his nonfiction, is how much he conveys. Like, his books are so kind of rich and dense without being particularly, like, texts that are not particularly long, that do not, you know, he just wastes no words, and he conveys an enormous amount. It has to do with, like, what he focuses on and the examples he gives and his turns of phrase, which are very memorable. But don't you think he has like a great power of sort of condensing and conveying so much in his writing?
It's kind of mind-blowing because, I mean, when you translate a text like this, you really have to feel like you get it, right? And he sort of tricks, I don't know if it's intentional, but he sort of, my experience of reading him, and like you said, across genres, is that you can kind of do a quick reading and feel like you got it. You know, you got the argument, or you got the storyline, you got the character, you got generally the gist. You may even have caught, you know, these turns of phrase and his metaphors and whatnot. But then if you come back and like try to do if you open yourself up to a careful reading, and, you know, translation is effectively like a very careful reading, or a slow reading, you realize that actually there's an immense amount of subtlety that he's hidden into these seemingly simple sentences, or quite complex sentences, run-on sentences. And so, yes, like I think, for instance, I would find myself having translated a line, and then when I come to do an edit, and maybe it's the third or fourth time I've come back to it, and I realize only on that fourth reading that the emphasis was somewhere that takes what is already a pretty good point, but that just subtle recognition that actually his emphasis is somewhere else, you realize that actually this is actually a really profound point. Like this is a really major point. And like this is a point you can just sort of sit with for a minute and should sit with for a minute, because you hadn't thought of it that way before, or it just sort of does tweaks a little bit how you're seeing something, how you're thinking of something, how you're understanding it.
So how did you end up back at this book? So you read it 18 years ago, and then what made you come back to it?
What happened was I had read that Dar Rimal volume 5 of the analytic writings. And I thought that the travelogue and the essay on Marxism were really, because they were unpublished especially, that they were things I would love to translate if a publisher appeared out of as a deus ex machina kind of, and just was like, hey, do you want to translate Kenneth Fanny? Which never happens, right? Right. So I wrote this book review on a website called Liberated Texts of the writings of the martyr Basil al-Araj, which is called Wajadtu Ajwibati, I Have Found My Answers. And somebody Layan Flihan, Layan Slima Flihan, who wrote the introduction to my translation of the Revolution of 1936. Layan had read that in the same moment where I think they were having a conversation at 1804 Books to kind of go back to publishing books, and that they had a connection with the family of Kenafani, who had given their blessing to translation of his work. And for 1804 to kind of publish translations of the work. And so that thing that never happens kind of happened. Layan got in touch and she said, hey, we read this thing and we think maybe you're a good choice of someone who could translate some of that stuff from volume 5. And I was like, if you had asked for me to translate anything else, I probably would have said no, but this one thing. So that was kismet. And then we went through sort of several conversations about selection. And, you know, this essay is probably, I don't know, I want to say his only nonfiction at the time. I mean, now we have On Zionist Literature as well. But at the time, I think it was one of the only pieces of nonfiction writing that he'd written, published or otherwise, that had already been translated. The PFLP Media Office arranged for a translation of it as early as 1974, I think. And it's not only did they do a translation, when Marxists.org, that website that makes available a lot of Marxist and Marxian writings from all over the world, they've hosted that translation on there free for everyone to access for years. That's where I'd read the English for the first time. The existing translation, I think it was done in a very particular moment, in a very particular style. I think not just me, but like several people had found that like it deserved a retranslation. There's been that conversation in the background for a while. I've heard it from several people and so on. And we decided to just do the retranslation of this essay. If anything, just to kind of bring it back into people's consciousness, and also to kind of update the translation. So that's how it came about.
And so what about you? When you think about who you would like the audience to be for the translation, how do you imagine it?
I think kind of like Kenneth Fanny publishing it in Shu'un Falastaniya, like everyone who cares. There's a lot in it for a lot of people, you know. So again, I think anybody studying history or interested in history should read it just for its methodology. How do you do a materialist history? That's not something that people get right often. There's not that many great material. You know, there's a lot of great materialist histories and historians, but not everybody who sets out to do that does it well. And this is done. This is an exemplary one, especially for someone without much access to, you know, archival material and data and whatnot, as was the case with on Zionist literature. He was constantly starving for source material, constantly. And, you know, like when you think of on Zionist literature, it's exceptionally the case because in Lebanon, Zionist literature would have been banned, was banned. This is not something that you could legally sell. And so he had to get his hands on it somehow. And he made extensive use of his wife's comrades in Denmark. So his wife was a Danish communist, Annie Kenefani, who gave her blessing for this revolution, for this translation. And who's been a tireless fighter, especially for Palestinian children, at least since her husband was assassinated. So they would basically kind of like, I think her comrades in Denmark would like, were given instructions to be on the hunt for anything they could find on the materials that Kenefani was interested in at any given time. But then you find, I mean, it's not as much the case with this book, but with On Zionist Literature, I spoke to the translators and they told me that, you know, like some of the footnotes are written from memory, not necessarily. And it was the case in this one, like I had to fix some of his citations by kind of looking up the sources that he cites and whatnot. But I think, he's basically like, he knows he's read it in this book. Doesn't have the book at hand, roughly around page 82, 83. and so there was this, and so the English translation, actually, they did do that immense labor. They did that immense labor of tracking down the source material and adjusting the footnotes so people who do want to go and find that material can go and see it.
I mean, again, what's extraordinary about him is the circumstances under which he produced so much and this effervescence that you find to his production, where you really get the feeling of someone who was in a rut, like in a rush in a good way, like,
well, you know, this is
stop writing not, yeah. And wrote so urgently about so many things.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't conjecture. So he was terminally ill. So there was this sense, I think, that he was going to die young. He had
I didn't
sense,
know that.
Certainty. Yeah, he had this almost near certainty that he was going to die young. And so he lived in this kind of race against time mode from the time of his diagnosis.
Huh. I just wanted to ask you one last question, which is today, I mean, it seems to me like there are so many reasons to read and reread Kenefani, and of course he's very well known in the Arab world, at least his literature certainly is and is a sort of reference point, but within his preoccupations, I mean, the question of what we can learn from history, the question of class interests and how they affect the success or failure of revolutionary moments, the question of the legitimacy and efficacy of armed struggle, like all of these questions that he brings up are as relevant today as they were then. How do you think that what does he mean to people today? Like what do you think his significance is to most of his readers?
Well, first of all, I think we need to note that those who knew him were immensely impacted by him. immensely. So my first ever kind of firsthand account of Kanafani was from a Palestinian, a PFLP leader now deceased, who I kind of like randomly was introduced to. I was trying to do interviews with people. And so he was in a wheelchair. He was, you know, quite elderly. And he was one of Kanafani's students in the UNRWA school, in Kanafani's art class in Damascus. And when he was talking about, you know, this is an old man with a booming voice, just a giant of a human. Like he had participated. I think he was the getaway car driver when they broke out George Habash from a Syrian prison. he told many stories that day, but the story where you could see his eyes kind of glass, like, you know, to turn childish again, turn to a certain kind of like mega nostalgia, was when he told this story about Ghassan Kanafani. He's like, first of all, that was the generation of giants. We were also the generation of giants. I don't know what y'all are. and sort of that kind of introduced, that sort of, you know, primed me for the story now. And then he's like, yeah, we were told that the Mufti, that Amin al-Husseini was going to come visit us at school. So this would have been sometime, I guess, in the 50s or even like, yeah, early 50s, mid 50s. And Ustaz Ghassan, you know, and Ghassan Kanafani comes and tells our class, look, this Mufti is coming. He's the guy who sold us out. Him and his people, they're the ones who ba'u bladna. They're the ones who sold our country. They're the ones who sold out Palestine. And effectively kind of like gives them a lecture on just like who they are. And remember, this is Kanafani before he's really a Marxist. This is before he's really kind of, he's just been recruited into the ANM in the last 2-3 years sort of thing when he was in Beirut. In Damascus, and at university in Damascus. When the Mufti actually does come to visit, all of the kids from that art class go down and start kicking him in the shins. Mufti. The headmaster has an aneurysm. Everybody gets punished very severely. but that was when, you know, so this wasn't just, and he spoke about many other figures that, you know, are people that I'd read about or heard about or, you know, imagined. But nothing quite like. And then my second was with somebody who I worked with in Canada. And he, every year on Kanafani, on the anniversary of Kanafani's assassination, he wrote a new eulogy, a new like obituary. So, every year, like a kind of update letter. Like, dear Ghassan, mm-hmm. in the last year, this is, you know, like, what would you be thinking now would be the kind of like tone of it. Look, I'm so glad you're not here to see this now, kind of tone, right? So just like a really deep, this wasn't like the performativeness of, oh, I knew Ghassan, please applaud me for having met this person in person, which is a kind of attitude you often hear around celebrity figures, or like, I have a picture with Arafat. It's like, yeah, take a number. This is like, it's a kind of visceral bodily missing of this person 40, 50 years later. So that's one, and this has maybe affected those in the direct circles or like me who have like briefly encountered, that again, bodily visceral change in someone when they talk about this person, to just prime me to be like, this is a special person. This isn't just, he's not just important as this person who like wrote some things we should read kind of thing. I think the rest of the answer in terms of like, what do people remember of and think of Ghassan Kanafani? I think my answer is not enough, honestly. I think it's really not about lionizing this person. I think a lot of people maybe approach this is one of our heroes canonized. And so he is one of the people who we put up a poster for in the bedroom or make our desktop background or post that, you know, one famous interview in English of him in his office in Beirut.
It's a pretty good interview, though.
No, it's great.
I know the one.
Yeah, phenomenal interview. And then like the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 quotes, again, great quotes, like no question about it, that float around, that don't even float around with the citation about the text that they're from. You know, we can't even, you're like, oh, but where did this come from? And then like, sometimes you're even asked like, oh, did he really say this? Like, and so there's so much to be done on just kind of like documenting his work and making it accessible, writing about it. I think there's also, you know, for instance, there's like a tendency to try to, because people have been so afraid of taking a more militant line that is in line with Kanafani, right? So there's nothing, there's no page in Kanafani that is not like, we are in a state of defiance and confrontation. That's on every page, every word, every sentence is about informing that and reinforcing that and theorizing that, and with this essay, historicizing that defiance and confrontation. But I think, like, you know, you end up with writing on him that sometimes maybe tries to minimize the fact that this guy was in the Politburo of a faction that sent people to train for the, you know, like, the use of military force to liberate territory from which to then move on to liberate more territory until the Arab world, at the very least, is free from Morocco to Iraq. And freedom is not just a freedom from foreign occupation, it's a freedom from tyranny and all forms of oppression. And that the point of our lives is things like beauty and joy and love. And that's that, and we need to constantly be striving for that, right? And so, you know, you can see Kanafani's imprint on the PFLP, for example, their emphasis that our movement is not for the liberation of Palestine as a land, it's a liberation of Palestinians as a people. And always noting that there is no such thing as Palestinians as something detached from the rest of the Arab society. And Arab society, not in the sense of a society that is not heterogeneous, right? So this is the same kind of politics that supports the liberation of Western Sahara and supports the liberation of Kurdistan and supports Amazigh, and, you know, this plurality and people, again, finding freedom, beauty, love, and joy in their lives. He has things to offer. His writings have a lot to offer this, you know, whether it's the fiction, the literary analysis, whether as method, as memorable kind of moments of feeling, those texts or works of art that affirm you in those moments of doubt and weakness. I think people should be reading and rereading A'id ila Haifa and Men, sorry, The Return to Haifa and Men in the Sun, and what has now been translated. But I think we need to keep going and get everything else translated and ask that question of him more systematically by looking through these texts, i.e. that question of, what do you have to offer us, Hassan? And even with just this sort of like small number of texts, the answer is like a whole hell of a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on to talk so extensively about Kanafani and his work.
Yeah, thank you.
My absolute pleasure.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.